Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In our increasingly networked and image-saturated lives, the notion of disappearing has never been both more enchanting and yet fanciful. Today, we are relentlessly encouraged, even conditioned, to reveal, share, and self-promote. A lifelong student and observer of the natural world, Akiko Bush set out to explore her own uneasiness with this arrangement and what she senses is a widespread desire for a less scrutinized way of life, for invisibility. She does so in her new book, How to Disappear: Notes on Invisibility in a Time of Transparency. Writing in detail about her own life, her family, and some of the world's most exotic and remote places, she savors the pleasures of being unseen. She discovers and dramatizes a wonderful range of ways of disappearing. Again, the name of the new book is How to Disappear: Notes of Invisibility in a Time of Transparency. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Akiko Bush to this week's book show. What a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe. I'm delighted to be here.
I am curious as to sort of a chicken and the egg question, but is it the transparency, the just that we are awash in transparency that gets you thinking about disappearing, or is it the actual act of disappearing that has you say, oh, why am I doing this?
No, actually, I think it's the former. I think that we live to see and to be seen. This is what human beings do. We live to be recognized, to be acknowledged. The gaze is vital to human connection. I think one reason the Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement have the great power that they do is because both of these movements restore social and political and cultural visibility to populations that have often gone unrecognized and unseen. So, yeah, we live to see and be seen. That said, it seemed to me that in this increasingly visual culture that we live in, the other side of that coin, the power or the value of being unseen and being unrecognized, undetected, of being inconspicuous and discreet and reserved, was beginning to lose its meaning. And it seemed to me that maybe it was time to we put so much value on being seen and visibility, and it seemed to me time to reevaluate the meaning of being unseen.
I don't want the irony to be lost that you and I are going to talk about this subject on a radio program.
I'm with you.
And we want people to hear it. And yet we're both people who would, you know, disappearing seems really nice.
Absolutely.
What is it about that, do you think, that we have both chosen professions that give us the opportunity to have our work listened to, and yet in my case, I'm in a small room all by myself, and you are writing in a small room all by yourself, and yet we get to communicate with the world outside mm-hmm. and not have to face it every day?
Well, I think being unseen can give one a sense of autonomy, privacy, individuality, voice. I think being unseen is not necessarily about having a sense of power, but just a sense of interiority, I think, that can be really vital to human expression. One of the things I realized when I started to think about invisibility and started to write about it was that for children, invisibility is a source of tremendous creativity. It's where they discover knowledge and self-knowledge, whether it's through invisible ink and, you know, writing with lemon juice in a toothpick and learning that words have a kind of evanescence, or whether it's in private places. Children's literature is full of, exactly as you say, people going off, kids going off to be by themselves, whether it's the unseen corridors of the plaza by Eloise, the wardrobe in Narnia. Children search out private places for solitude. Likewise, the invisible friend, who was long regarded as a sign of some kind of dysfunctional childhood, has since been recognized as a kind of consort that allows a child to work through isolation or loneliness or disappointment or all kinds of different experiences. And imagining the invisible friend is a creative exercise. So I think for kids, the invisible world is a place of tremendous knowledge and power. And it's only as adults that we begin to associate invisibility with transgression.
I don't think I've ever said goodbye to my invisible friend.
Oh, lucky you.
There's times in the car, in the shower, where I still, there's a communication there. And yes, this is something that I talk to my therapist about. But yet still, we find that, I find that as a comfort.
Well, whether it's the invisible friend you had as a child or whether it's just, I mean, we all talk through things, as
right.
you say, in the shower, in the car,
right.
when we're by ourselves.
Yeah.
We talk things through with our partners who may not be there or people that we're trying to frame a reply to. So I think
sure.
the conversation with the unseen person is again, an example of the invisible friend.
For me, you were talking about Narnia. For me, it was The Land of Counterpane, Robert Louis Stevenson.
Oh, okay.
Are you familiar
okay,
with that?
Okay, no.
Oh, it's
no.
a lovely, lovely poem about a child who is sick in bed and just he has these toys and just creates this entire world by what is in his bed. And it's amazing. I'm struck by this idea. You mentioned the invisible friend, and I'm going to leap forward a little bit because you write in here about invisible ink. And you have this beautiful description, as you just said, about the toothpicks and the lemon juice. And then you make a very quick turn to your father's CIA files. And I'm like, wow, that is what a story that is.
My father was in the OSS. My father had been a journalist, and he was in the OSS in Southeast Asia after that. And ultimately, many years later, he was thinking of writing his memoirs. So he asked to see his classified CIA documents. And the day they arrived at our household, they were, you know, it was a completely redacted document. You could barely make it out. I mean, there were just huge chunks of just blacked out material. So it did not really reveal to him much about his life or what the CIA thought about his time in Thailand and in Japan. But my father himself, he was a biographer. He also read Proust and loved Proust. So for him, memory and loss of memory and how language shifts over time and all of these ideas about how human identity shifts over time and how we remember some things more than others, all of these were vital to his way of thinking. And so in our family, the redacted files, first they were kind of a joke. And then, you know, to my eye, in any event, it seemed like a kind of appropriate way to document his life.
But don't you think that impacts you as to how you feel about disappearing, of how you feel about invisibility?
I'm not sure how much that actually impacts me. That's a good question. I would have to think about that. I think I grew up in a house, probably the way most people did, where there were unknown things, where there were some secrets. And I think I would argue that secrets can, sometimes they can be a good thing. Sometimes the unknown and the unsaid can empower us. And not everything can be said, not everything can be shared, I guess is the point I'm making.
So do you think that there's a part of all of us that wants to disappear, or that it strikes people as a goal more than others?
I'm not sure I would see it as a goal, but I think that especially in this age of tremendous, you know, we kind of measure our lives by the degree to which we're seen and known and visible. So I think for all of us, it can be a kind of respite. It can be kind of refreshing to step back and realize, you know, maybe all those Instagram followers aren't the most important thing. Maybe there is something about keeping something to yourself, about understanding your own sense of interiority that can, you know, work in kind of conjunction with the public lives we all live.
Akiko Bush is the author of How to Disappear, Notes on Invisibility in a Time of Transparency. The word that I kept on coming to in the book that I just kept on thinking about when it comes to disappearing, when it comes to transparency, is tranquility. That there is a sense of tranquility in that.
Absolutely.
Of disappearing.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. I think that ties into the idea I have of interiority, where you're just, there's a kind of self-assurance that comes when you realize your identity is not a matter of your public persona.
Now, you can see this, but that was the first word I wrote down when we started talking was interiority, because that is a fascinating word. To you, what does that mean, and what does that allow us?
I think what's vital is having the choice of when we reveal something about ourselves and when we don't. And I think one of the difficulties that many teenagers have is that, you know, just this kind of impulse or this expectation that everything will be put out there, everything will be posted. And if you don't post it, your friends will post it. And I think it's really vital for human beings to be able to have the choice of when they reveal something, whether it's to another person or whether it's to a broader public. And I think if you lose sight of having that choice and choosing what you keep to yourself and really only revealing those important things about yourself when and if you choose to those people or that person you choose to share it with, I think that's vital to kind of developing your sense of self and knowing who you are. So I think what I mean by interiority is just being clear on that choice of what you reveal and what you don't.
We're in an age now where we have reveal parties. We're going to reveal the sex of the baby. We're going to reveal whether we're getting married or not, or whatever. Some monumental decision that we've made in our lives, that we're going to reveal that. And I think I come from a time where, you know, you didn't know the sex of a child when you had. That was a surprise. Surprises like that seem okay to me sometimes.
Oh, I'm with you. It's so interesting to me. I think it was 4 or 5 years ago when the Malaysian airliner went down.
Right.
You know, it disappeared. It was out of view. It crashed into the ocean. And for a very, very long time, a matter of years, I think, no one knew where it was. And I think one of the reasons that story captured the public imagination the way it did, other than it was a plane crash and many people were lost and beloved family members were lost. We're unaccustomed to accepting this idea of disappearance and mystery, and something is gone and we don't know where it is. It's almost something our imagination can hardly grasp anymore in this age of great visibility. So, yeah, I think if we could just learn to accept disappearance and mystery a little more, we'd probably all be better off.
That idea of mystery is fascinating, because there was a time where we didn't know something was going to be announced until it was announced. And now we know if a candidate is going to choose a vice presidential choice, we know who it is before they're announced. We know who the Supreme Court nominee is going to be before it's announced. There was a time when we didn't know that, and there was something cool about that.
Oh, there was something wonderful about that. I mean, you know, you go to dinners now where people aren't allowed to bring, or they're asked not to bring their iPhones to the dinner table so people can speculate and conjecture, and you're not always jumping up and, you know, looking up the answer on your phone. But there's a sense of speculation and questioning. And yeah, I think we could all use a little more of that.
The name of the book is How to Disappear. Did you find a true way to disappear?
It's not that I was looking for a real way to disappear. I mean, there was some technology I was interested in, you know, VR headsets where the mind-body connection is disrupted. But I was more interested in ways of being. I reread Mrs. Dalloway, for example, which was a really interesting experience for me because, of course, I had read it as a teenager. But reading it now as an older woman, it was a very different experience. And what I found was, you know, it's this beautiful story. It begins, she's walking down a London street and she feels unnoticed and unobserved. And she's an older woman beyond childbearing years. And so she's not really looked at. But she kind of laments that. But she also finds that she is, I can't remember quite how Virginia Woolf puts it, but she says she has more instinctive affinities. She connects with people. She has affiliations with people she's never met before, whether it's a man on the street or a woman behind a shop counter. And she finds that she's more, you know, kind of just more connected to the human family at large. And I mean, I think it would be ludicrous to say that she's a woman of low social standing. I mean, she wears a silk dress to her dinner party and the table is set with roses and silver. But because she is an older woman beyond childbearing years, she's not really looked at. And she finds that that sense of invisibility, and that is a word she uses, kind of allows her to connect more easily with people. And I was really interested in that. Virginia Woolf was, she was a pretty smart writer. And I think there's been a lot of modern social research that bears out her speculations there, that when we feel unseen, we tend to connect more with other people. And I think that's terrific.
Is there a connection to a desire to disappear, a desire to be invisible, that comes with the label, which I don't like, but a label of the extrovert versus the introvert?
I'm not sure how I would answer that. I think regardless of your type, whether you're one or the other, it's really vital. We all need those moments of just backing off and not being visible. So I'm not sure how it fits into those different, the different Myers-Briggs types. So,
well, meaning that if you had a sense of the want, the desire to tell people everything and to be very outward at a party, it seems that if you're the opposite of that and you're the person who's against the wall, that perhaps, and I'm going to identify as that, that we would then find it easier and more wanting to disappear.
Well, I think what's key for me is being able to make that choice. I mean, I think Right. Even the most extroverted people tend to be careful about what they're saying, what they're revealing, what they're showing. So I think so long as you're conscious of the choices you're making, you know, what you're revealing and what you're not, I think that's the important thing.
And isn't that sort of the problem that comes as a result of sharing so much, that some people aren't as conscious as others?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You write in the book about the geography of invisibility. Talk a little bit about that, of your exploration of the geography of this.
Well, I had long heard that in Iceland there is a population of invisible people, a population called the Huldufólk. And to this day, their influence is very strong in Iceland. So I wanted to go. I wanted to go and sort of see what it was like to live with, for a population to live with this, kind of this parallel population of unseen people. And the really great thing about the Huldufólk is that they're like us. They look like us. Their animals look like us. They live in homes like us, but they're just a little bit better. They're a little more attractive than we are. Their cows produce richer milk and cream. Their horses have glossier coats and run faster. So it's a kind of idealized population. And it's not that people sort of have conversations or have these kind of, you know, profound relationships with the unseen. It's more just an acceptance that there is an unseen universe. There is a universe that isn't visible and apparent to us. And there's a respect for that. Their kids go off and, you know, play with the Huldufólk kids. There's just a kind of acceptance of a world that isn't in front of our eyes, and I felt that there was something important about that to witness.
In that witnessing, do you feel that they are happy, that they are at peace with that?
I'm not sure about how happy or how at peace they are, but I think it's a kind of broad view to the human experience to be able to accept the idea that there is so much unseen in our lives. Everywhere I went, especially in the eastern part of the island, of the country, they would tell me where to go. They would say, oh, go to this field, you'll find this gray rock there. Or, you know, they would sort of tell me where to go, and I'd say, well, you know, do people really live there? And they would, the woman would, who I was speaking to, would shrug and say, oh, I don't know. There's just so much that we don't know and can't see. So it was just a kind of different way of approaching human experience that seemed very all-encompassing to me.
Is there ever a link to the spiritual, to the religious?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I think metaphysical inquiry always acknowledges the unseen. I mean, that would have been a whole different book unto itself of how different spiritual faiths acknowledge the unseen. So, yeah, absolutely.
With this desire to disappear that many have, does it... How do you feel about the art of disappearing? Are we in a good place? Are we still able, with all that we have and all of the technology that allows us to share, intentionally or not, every breath that we take, is the fate of disappearing, I guess? What is the fate of
that? Well, I think the way I think about that is it's not about checking out. I'm not advocating checking out, putting your hands over your ears, not responding, not being engaged in any kind of social way. I think what I'm after instead is just reconsidering, thinking about disappearing and thinking about being invisible. It's just a different way of positioning ourselves in the greater scheme of things. We live in a world in which we live in a world in which there'll be 9 billion people soon. The planet is warming, and I think what's the important thing will be not how we stand out in the world as individuals, and it won't be about our personal selves and our personal branding, but more about how we accommodate ourselves to the community, to the collective, and how we see ourselves as one in a greater whole.
This really gets down to the whole thing that we were taught at children, really. Though it seems to me that there's the city mouse and the country mouse, right?
Yeah, there is that.
There's a reason that I live in the middle of nowhere on the top of a mountain and don't have the neighbors, and when a snowstorm comes, you think, oh my God, it could be a couple of days before anyone gets to me. That's lovely.
Well, yeah, of course that's true. But look at what you do every day. You come to the studio and you speak to the world. So it's this kind of way of understanding and balancing this need to be unseen and invisible and private. And then when you choose to go out and put your voice into the world.
And that's what I got out of the book, is that there is, that this can should be much more conscious, that we have the decision of when we're invisible and when we're not.
Yes, absolutely.
The name of the book is How to Disappear, Notes on Invisibility in a Time of Transparency. I mentioned tranquility. Serenity comes into it as well. And those are possible things, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
When you look at the challenges of disappearing, the challenges of because I love this idea of notes on invisibility, and that it can be somewhat random, can it? Like, we can take those moments when we can get them.
Oh, I think that's very true. This is not a handbook. This is not an instructional guide. This is, this is just about different ways of being. I mean, I put the VR headset on. I went to Iceland. I went scuba diving, because being underwater, you're in an entirely different realm, and you see this kind of vast carnival of fish and invertebrates in the deep blue sea, and they're oblivious to you, and you're oblivious to them. I was just interested in finding different kinds of experience where we kind of understand what it is to be somewhat disconnected from what's going on around us. And how that can be of value, and how it has different iterations in human experience. And it may not be something you can necessarily plan for, but I felt that if I could just look at different kinds of human experience that explore this, then it would be part of my life in a greater way.
The book is beautiful. It's How to Disappear, Notes on Invisibility in a Time of Transparency. It is published by Penguin Press. Akiko Bush, what a great pleasure to have you on the program, as always.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight.
A delight. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows by going to wamc.org. also via podcast. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.